richness of friendship, the richness of new insights, the richness of camaraderie, all those sorts of things are just so precious and so much counterbalance the obviously we have to face up to them, but nevertheless the physical costs of being here. So nevertheless, thank you very much for being here. Now, from the time seminars were held maybe 7-8 years ago, we've made a point of focusing on Arcana Celestia, particularly the chapters that cover the books of Genesis and Exodus. And this is part of that continuum. I'm interested that David has said in his session that divine love and wisdom may well become the next continuum, so far as books of the writings are concerned. Or it could be, of course, that the whole thing will go back to the beginning again and start again with Genesis 1 and take us through to right through to the end of Exodus. So we're coming to the end of Exodus today. The request put to me was, would I deal with Exodus 33? And I will hope in the time allotted to unpack it for you and also to relate it to the processes of what we call glorification and redemption. Parallel processes, they go hand in hand, in other words. You can't really separate out the one from the other. So, as I said, in time, I'm going to look at the process of glorification and redemption with regard to this chapter 33. What I've done, and because of time, but nevertheless, what I've done is I've given you a handout sheet, and I've actually quoted from Arcana Celestia 10570, which is part of the treatment in the 12th volume of Arcana Celestia of Exodus chapter 33. Now, I've got here at the outset, please read and reflect on this. How do you handle statements in the writings such as these, so many of them, and sometimes taken even to be anti-Semitic? There are two papers that I know of in the last 15 or 20 years that have been published within the New Church, one by the Reverend Don Rose on Swedenborg and the Jews, and another paper that Jack Benson prepared as well, and I think he gave it as a talk at the Swedenborg Centre in Sydney, on Swedenborg and the Jews, because there's some quite brutal statements in the writings about the Jews. And can I just say that I personally believe that the new church is being protected by the Lord at this stage, because we, as yet, those of us who have a sense of loyalty and commitment to the writings, we as yet don't know how to properly manage and handle these kinds of statements. And I think the Lord is quite deliberately keeping us quiet so that we know and can grow into such a way that we can manage those statements when we're exposed to a much bigger audience. Now, that, as I say, applies not just to statements in the writings about the Jews, but because that's a sensitive topic and anti-Semitism is such a strong and emotionally charged issue, anti-Semitism, as it has been read into, I don't agree with it, but I'm saying as it has been read into the writings, is highlighted and needs a bit of attention. So, you have statements, and this one, I've got others by the way, but this one I chose, as I said, from the treatment in the Arcana on Exodus 33. It says here, with reference to Exodus 33:16, and I and your people will be made more distinguished than all the people who are on the face of the ground. Quote, it was this end in view, that they should be made more distinguished than all throughout the whole world, that caused the Israelite nation to worship Jehovah and enable them to be outwardly holy. This is clear from what has been shown previously regarding that nation. The fact that such people are able to be outwardly holy and to seem to others to be worshippers of God is clear from the idolaters spoken of in the historical narratives of the word, who were able in like manner to do the outward things. But anyone may see and deduce that these idolaters possess no inner holiness from the consideration of the divine truths which have been revealed in the Word and what make worship internal when people know them and live a life in keeping with them. Since that nation was such that their end in view to be preeminent over others enabled them to be outwardly holy, and since among such people such as these the things that are representative of celestial and spiritual realities, which the outward things of their worship were, can be conveyed to angels and a link with heaven can thereby be established, that nation was accepted. But anyone who supposes that this made them worshippers of God is very much mistaken, for they were worshippers of self and the world and idolaters at heart. And because they were such, neither was any revelation given them of the interior things of worship, which have to do with faith in the Lord and love to him. This is evident from the books of the Old Testament and also from the fact that they did not acknowledge the Lord when he came into the world and indeed still do not acknowledge him. And if presented with teachings about the Lord contained in the prophetical parts, even there, then do they not accept them. They desire a Messiah who will exalt them above all throughout the whole world, not a Messiah whose kingdom is in heaven and who looks from here to the salvation of all on earth. From all this it becomes clear what that nation has been like since the earliest ages. And I tie it in with a quote from 4911. People who are governed, as this nation is, by loves that are filthy, that is by avarice and by self-love accompanying this, are unable to raise their minds to a level where truth is seen from a viewpoint other than themselves. As I said, I have other quotes which are, like I used the word before, are equally stark, equally brutal, equally strong. And, for example, Apocalypse explained 8:30, subsection 5, they confess Jehovah with the mouth, alone and still at heart acknowledge other gods. They believe divine worship could consist entirely in external things. Theirs was a retributive attitude towards others, eye for eye, tooth for tooth, and so on. Life for life, even. Now, you could also, as I said and indicated, you could also pick up on what the writings say about Roman Catholics, which can be quite embarrassing. You can also pick up what the writings say about the Reformed or the Protestant, which also can be quite embarrassing. You get into Apocalypse Revealed, which was the first book of the writings, which I know Kevin read. And fortunately, in his case, it doesn't seem to have been a stumbling block, but nevertheless, we have got these things said. And I ask the question, why have they been included? Well, they are part of the judgment process, and they are part of what has been necessary, that what Roman Catholics or what the Jews or what the Protestants of old represented should be consigned to the garbage bin. That's part of judgment. I think they're also there as a warning lest those falsities recur, and let's not sidestep the issue that even within the new church we can fall prey to the evils which are associated with the Jews or the Roman Catholics or the Reformed or whoever they may be. And as I indicated or perhaps suggested when I referred to Kevin, I also believe that they are part of the Lord's protection for profanation. That comes up this afternoon with regard to the book Divine Providence. But if people are going to be put off, then well and good, perhaps they need to be put off. Okay? If they can't process and work with these strong statements, then maybe that's a good thing. So that's just a few comments and observations about the statements I'm talking about. But I want to say something else. I notice what David said in his talk about our need to regard the book Divine Love and Wisdom as revelation. And I wholeheartedly endorse that. But I urge something else. I urge this. All revelation, Old Testament, New Testament, the writings, is about you and I. It is not about anybody else. I am not in the least bit interested in what has been extrapolated from the writings about the past or about other people. I believe the Lord, when he reveals himself to us, is only interested in your and my spiritual growth, regeneration, and salvation. And so I'm urging you not only to read the writings as being divine revelation, but as reading the writings as being the Lord talking to you about your very own life. So stop going to scripture or stop going to the writings and picking it up as if it is a judgment or a mirror reflecting something about other people. When the Lord said things on earth such as, where two or three are gathered together, there I am in the midst of them, stop thinking about things outside. Think about what it's saying to you about your world in here. It's all about your world. If there's a straight way and a narrow way, it's all about what's going on in here or what is possible within here. And I think this is one of the gifts that the new church can give to the world. The Bible is not there as something, all the writings are not there to be held up as a light to reflect on the lives of other people or of the world at large around us. All revelation is given to be a light to shine in our own lives. And so, coming to the writing specifically, when it comes to the Jews or the Old Testament Israelites, when it comes to the Roman Catholics, when it comes to the Reformed, stop. Stop and disregard any inclination you may have to read that as comment or judgment on other groups of people or organizations. It is nothing of the sort. It is comment and it is observation about what goes on in us or what is potential within us. That's what it is. And so, my beg you to read the writings in that light. What is this saying to me? What of the Roman Catholic have I got? What of the Reformed I've got? Because I most certainly have them. And what is Roman Catholicism in a nutshell? It is the desire to control and dominate the lives of others. Have you got that in you? I have. And what is the Reformed in a nutshell? The Reformed so-called church in a nutshell? Well, in Dick Keyworth's words, it is to want the benefits without the work. To want the benefit of salvation without putting any effort in. Have I got that? My goodness, I've got it. And I've got it in good measure. So the writings are speaking to me as they're speaking to you about these possibilities, these evils that so easily erupt in our own lives and need judgment and the light shone on them so that we can see them for what they are. Let's say that because that's how we need to read. Like I said, they are brutal and they are unmistakably like a sword that cuts through these problem passages in the writings. Now I want to turn specifically to Exodus chapter 3, chapter 33. You probably know that Exodus chapter 20 was when Moses went up Mount Sinai to be given the Ten Commandments. You probably don't know as well, so well, that the next something like 12 chapters are still with Moses up at Mount Sinai receiving all sorts of rules and laws to govern the behavior of the people, and he received as well instructions about the building of the tabernacle. So just bear that in mind. I'm sorry about the board and the shine, but Exodus 20 is Sinai and the Ten Commandments. Exodus 32, when you get into Exodus 32, as you read into Exodus 32, this is following on from the people making and worshipping a golden calf. So that's been happening while Moses was up on the mountain. He was up there for over 6 weeks, it was just in 6 weeks. And as you know, Aaron got involved in the absence of Moses in making this golden calf. And then right towards the end of Exodus 32, there's the slaughter. Moses calls the particularly the Levites to him, and the people of the tribe of Levi. They go throughout the camps and they kill 3,000 of the most of the worst offenders. How Aaron escaped that, I don't know. But then you get into chapter 32, now right at the end. God tells Moses to go on leading the people to the promised land, and his angel will go with him and with the people. That's where chapter 32 ends. And you get into chapter 33, and there is a repetition of this, God telling Moses to go on leading the people to the promised land. His angel will go with him, but says that he himself will not go with them. He's had enough of them. So he says, I'm not going, but you get on with it and go. But I'll let you have the angel, and he'll show you the way. And the people grieve. There's actually, they strip their ornaments and get into mourning gear, and they're grieving. And that's the first five verses. Then Moses 7 to chapter 33, verses 7 to 11, is where we're told about Moses pitching his tent way outside the camp, where he meets with God. And in fact, if you're not going to be careful here, you'll think it's the tabernacle, but it's not the tabernacle. It is the tent of meeting. Okay, it's the tent of meeting. It's quite a lovely little section here, because although the tent is well outside the camp, the pillar of cloud descends. Moses goes into it. When he goes into it to meet with God, all the people step out of their tents because they've seen the pillar of cloud, and they're watching what's going on down there. Lovely little section. So that's verses 7 to 11. And then when you get into 12 to 23, Moses pleads with God to change his mind and go with them. And God is pretty reluctant about it all, but he then kind of comes towards Moses, but says, you'll never see me. You remember that famous part? You'll only ever see me from the back parts. You'll not see me face to face. Although, talking about contradiction in a literal sense, back here in this section, Moses is quite happily meeting God face to face. How are you, mate? That sort of thing's going on. So you get all this, but I just wanted to put you in the picture where Exodus 33 is concerned. And now I want to come back a little bit more towards the what I said earlier about the quality of the Old Testament Israelites, as they are stated to have been in the writings. And in summary, I've made my own summary, but from what has been said, what do you remember what is said? What is it about the Israelites of old, and
a stiff-necked people.
They are stiff-necked, yes. And what else?
Idolaters.
They're idolaters, yes. They're idolaters, readily so.
Unfaithful.
They're, pardon me?
Unfaithful.
They're unfaithful, yep. Right, they're unfaithful, yep. They are focused on externals. Externals matter. And they're all show. Okay, they're all show. That's some of the things that you can garner from what is said. Right? Stiff-necked, idolaters, unfaithful, focused on externals, and excuse me, they're all show. I've also made in my own notes, they thought, it's like the child's t-shirt that Margaret and I were rejecting when we saw it in Big W all came out the other day. They thought it was all about me. Really did. They thought it was all about me. Now, I want to just get you to start relating to those qualities, because I do put it to you that there is the Jew in each of us. Stiff-necked, idolaters, priorities, that in other words, our priorities get all askew. We turn things upside down. We're unfaithful. We are focused so much on externals, and we often think and fall into the trap of the thinking of salvation will rest in our observance of externals. We can be all show, masking a different story within, and we can think that it's all about me. Why me, for example? That's all about me. So these are some of the things I want you to stop and think about. When you get into the Arcana section that deals with Exodus 33, it is so heavily into this state of the Jews. But you've got to get back out of it. It's a bit like treacle if you're not careful. You've got to get back out of it and realize that what it's dealing with is the natural states we are in and go through. Right. Now, there's some wonderful teaching in True Christian Religion, for example, which talks about, this is True Christian Religion 344, and it talks about the progression of stages of faith. Have a read of it. It's too often neglected. True Christian Religion 344. And what that brings home to us is that all of us, no wriggle room, all of us begin with a natural faith. So we are all in Exodus 33. And through regeneration, we move on from there to a spiritual faith and to a celestial faith, as the Lord may see fit. So this indeed, never mind it being all about me in the way we talked about it a moment ago, Exodus 33 is all about us. Very, very much all about us. Now, this really does, for me, bring it home. We're talking about a natural state, a pre-regenerate state. I want to leave those qualities up there. But if you just stop and think a moment, what did I say? If that's the camp, what did I say? Where did Moses have his tent?
Outside.
Outside. Well, what did he do in the tent?
Meet.
He met with God. Moses met with God outside. Well outside. The Bible makes it plain. It's well outside, a good distance outside. And that alone is a picture of either this pre-regenerate natural state we are in, or state of natural faith. When God is outside, even though we might meet with him by reading our Bibles or reading a passage in the writings, we can do all of those things. If those of you are doing local practice on divine providence, Darren, you know, I'm amazed that section is saying we can do all of these things. We can even seem to love these things. And yet, our meeting with God is well outside the camp. It's not inside the camp at all. Now, in time, however, in time, what succeeded this tent of meeting? I mentioned it before.
The tabernacle.
The tabernacle. But where was the tabernacle?
In the middle.
It was in the middle. And what came after the tabernacle? The temple. So, see, can you see that True Christian Religion passage is beautifully brings home to us this development that takes place. You get a natural faith, a spiritual faith, and a celestial faith, a really confirmed faith. I love it. It wasn't original with me, but I always remember that the tabernacle and the time of the tabernacle represents a state of flexibility and fluidity in our regeneration. They're on the move. The tabernacle's being carried and lifted from place to place. And that's very much reflective of this more spiritual faith, yes indeed, but it is a more fluid state we're in. We're not really into a totally confirmed state such as we come into when the temple is erected. So this is, I say, this is giving you the background to chapter 33. Now I want to move into Genesis and Exodus and glorification and redemption. What does the book of Genesis begin with?
Creation.
And what does it end with?
It's Joseph in Egypt.
What was Joseph doing?
Ruling Egypt.
He was ruling. It's just remember that, because the book of Genesis, with regard to the innermost level of meaning, is about the Lord's glorification. And it takes us wonderfully through the Lord's experiences, even as a very young child. There's marvellous teaching there. Genesis chapter 12, the call of Abram, for example, is about the Lord's first awakening, possibly as a boy, as young as 3 or 4, that something was different about his life and that he had a mission that was probably different from other children he was mixing with. The call of Abram is the awakening within the Lord as a very young child of a sense of divine call. So that takes us right through all the adventures, the setbacks, the jealousies, the supplanting, all that kind of thing, right through to Joseph. And he is not only ruling, but what is he doing? He is feeding the world. And what did Jesus say? I am the bread of life. So you have there the Lord having now reached the culmination of glorification. It's the Arcana is the most incredible treasure trove of insights into understanding the inner life of the Lord from the time of his conception, Angel Gabriel, right through to his rise to power and him becoming the bread of life, the feeder of the world. So that's Genesis. Now, Exodus is, like I said, it's all about the parallel process. And Exodus is about redemption. What's another word for redemption?
Saving. Regenerate.
Yeah? I want to get you back into Exodus. What happened at the beginning of, or near the beginning of Exodus? What happened? Think scriptural.
Slavery.
So you get slavery and you get liberation. Liberation. That's a good summary of what redemption is about. Freeing from slavery, liberation, being set free. The world was serving tough taskmasters when the Lord came into the world. You and I don't realize it, but in our pre-regenerate times and in our unregenerate states, we are serving tough taskmasters. We tell ourselves otherwise, we justify what we're doing, but we're in reality serving very, very tough taskmasters. Now, what is not wrong for me to do, but I want to just show you something. I'm going to do for Exodus my line down this way. Because as the Lord's glorification progressed, and as the deeper and more arcane levels of the Lord's life were being explored and glorified, so redemption at itself, a deeper level, was taking place. Did I make that clear? So, wonderfully, when you get towards the end of the Lord's glorification, you're actually getting, in Exodus, to the point where the Lord is really dealing with the tough and ugly stuff of human nature. And that is that. The stiff-necked idolatry, the unfaithful, the focused on externals, the all show, the thinking that it's all about me. So the Lord, towards the end of the glorification process, had to confront the awfulness of the state of the natural level of human existence. And it was ugly stuff. So ugly that sometimes you recoil when you read it, because it's no different today. I still sit there with the book of the writings open, and when I read that I am capable, from the love of self, of wanting to control all people in the world, or to possess all the goods of the world, I say, I can't be like that. But I am. I have to acknowledge I am. Or else I'm in a sort of a self-denial where the Lord can't help me. Now, this is what Exodus 33 is bringing home to us in a wonderfully powerful, unforgettable way. He is dealing with, in the later stages of his glorification process, with these natural states. Love, one of my most favorite passages in the writings about the Advent is where it reads that as a result of glorification, the Lord, this is Arcana Celestia 3195, subsection 3, as a result of glorification, he was able to bring light not only to man's rational concepts, but to his natural ideas. Glorification can be also thought of as the Lord progressively shining light into human nature as he was experiencing it, and as he had inherited it from Mary, shining light into it, even down to the level of a cheeky driver who cuts you off when the roadworks are coming up, or the price of tomatoes in Rosalie compared to Oldie. The Lord is able to get alongside of us right down where we're operating at that most external and natural of levels, and to regenerate, or to work with us for the regeneration of that natural level. That's what Exodus 33 is telling us. How are we going for time? What I'm going to do now is to, I want you to do something which can be a challenge, but I've now photocopied sections from the Arcana that deal, talk volume which deal with Exodus 33, and I want you to just get a feel for the way the writings talk about it. And describe it as 4 or 5 pages, and I just pause before we do go on to that, and ask you anything that you want to stop over.
I think you saved me because I was getting a bit worried about you saying that the story of the Lord's glorification, and before you said all revelation is about us, and now we're talking about the internal arcane processes the Lord went through, and I'm thinking, so what does that mean to me? But I think you were saying at the end that it's the Lord is actually glorified in how we appreciate him in the smallest details of our lives, and that's what that glorification means, not that
same arcane. As redemption helmet, it's an abstraction unless we see it in terms of our slavery, our liberation, our progress, our being willing to, like tried to say, our being face up to the potential we all have in a unregenerate way, all of those sorts of things. And so I think the Lord is saying to us here, look, this is how I can work with you. As I am glorified in you, so you will discover redemption, i.e. liberation. It will be a process. We will only deal with the stuff of the stuff. You know, the old analogy of the onion. You peel off the first, and that's how regeneration is. Go back to the beginning of Exodus, we're only peeling off the outer ring of the onion. Get back here, we're getting really into the stuff that stings. It stings when you're getting down in here.
Yeah, I think because most, the natural way of thinking is that I've been in this work for X length of time and it should be getting better. Whereas the reality is that on one level, yes, that is true. You're still heading for the tabernacle and the temple. But the thing is that what you have to deal with to get there is those deeper and more subtle, the more subtle kind of stuff that happens in comparison of tomato crisis. I mean, the interesting thing in the chapter that I'm doing on Sunday is all about the free will, bringing freely all the material from the tabernacle. That's a free will offering. So the slavery is actually hanging on to spiritual things and claiming them for oneself. And so that process that you describe there, eventually the release is actually acknowledging that all is from the Lord, not from a head space, but from an actual life experience.
And it immediately brought back to mind when the people grieved because God says, no, forget you, you know, clear off, and I'm not going with you, they start stripping all the jewellery off themselves. So, but up till then, they're quite happy to decorate themselves. Now, that's like us. You know, we're quite happy to decorate ourselves in God's glory when it suits us, but when when things get tough, pull it all off.
it's essentially what you're saying is that it gets more subtle, because I've been thinking, you know, the external world is a reflection of our inner states collectively, and people sometimes say, oh, the world is getting worse place to live in, and things like that, but technically it's the poles are getting wider apart. But I sort of realise it's not actually that the poles are getting wider apart, is that how those poles express themselves changes in more wider variety, and that allows us to get into those little subtleties that otherwise wouldn't have expressed come up to the surface. And so that, to me, it's a beautiful picture that the world, as it stands so collectively, we're going in the right direction.
Yeah. Added to which core is, I sometimes have said that, you know, without presuming regeneration, but nevertheless on the basis that regeneration is taking place, we also become more sensitive. Our conscience is developed more strongly, and so we, like you were saying, David, about it seems tougher, but it seems tougher because conscience is speaking to us more assertively than it did do, and so what was something we could be glib about and pass over, particularly as a young person, becomes something that fills you with horror, later on down the track in your regeneration. That's enough.
Talking about regeneration of the individual, when you consider the whole human race, my feeling is, my belief is, that it's getting better. Mm-hmm. The whole human race is making progress. I mean, there's plenty of backward steps there, but overall, I think that it's going forward. Do you agree with
that? I definitely agree. I just came up briefly last night for a conversation, but I definitely agree that post last judgment, I think, you know, I quote the words of a now long past on New Church minister who said that we of the New Church have every right to be long term optimists even if we are short term pessimists. Never forgotten that there are things that worry us, but we have every reason to be long term optimists. Can I just pause myself here and just, I said something before which none of you have picked up on, and that is that I said that the state of the natural degree or level within each of us is as bad as it was 2,000 years ago. Mm. How can it have been, I was waiting for you to say, if at that stage the Lord needed to come? Why doesn't he need to come again? What's different about the world 2,000 years on compared to... And do you know the answer?
Well, he does need to come again, but in each of us individually.
He does, yeah. But as a general... what is different about the overall situation? The answer is awareness. Evils were condoned and allowed for 2,000 years ago, and there was no conscience about it, no resistance or protest, whereas with the Lord's first coming, which was a coming to do with the will, by the way, the second coming is to do with the understanding, with the Lord's comings, I'll put it that way, with the Lord's comings, we now have light, or access to light, which from which we protest famine in the Horn of Africa or atrocity elsewhere, whereas people then didn't have the same reaction to it. So I always find, looking at historical films, they leave me a little bit cold, although I like all the dress-ups and all that sort of thing, and the Roman arenas, but I actually have problems because they impose our awareness on those situations that are not were not accurate of the times.
Which puts them in a very bad light when you do that.
Well, yeah. Yes, and that's why we got to the point, as we all know, where had the Lord not come, then the human race would have just gone straight into an abyss of unconscionable behaviour. It was already becoming unconscionable, but it would have just simply become totally unconscionable behaviour.
When I've been thinking about just having finished divine law and wisdom actually, is that to me the feeling comes that if the Lord hadn't come to maintain this external realm, it would have been completely disintegrated.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm. This whole realm would no longer exist. It would cease to exist, and by definition, our ability to exist would cease at the same time.
But wouldn't that, if there was not the natural level, then the whole of heaven would have ceased to exist as well, would it?
There is. It's the passage says that other earths are quite capable of sustaining the heavens that this earth presently sustains.
Yes.
Right.
Yeah,
One of the, in the section, the chapter of the AC that I'm doing on Sunday, I think it's in there. There's a discussion in the interchapter material at the end, which is the fifth earth and starry heaven. But the discussion there is it's not there. It's in another part. But that's okay. And, what the discussion is about is the fact, you know, the establishment of the written text on this earth being such a vital aspect, so that as generations pass, those access to those texts is still available, whereby you can, even if you don't have a conscience, if you come to those texts, it gives an externalized conscience, I suppose, in that sense, you know. So I think one of the biggest things that survives through that is albeit a natural sort of perspective, but the idea of God as man. it's something that can be related to. That's the critical thing.
Yeah, I was just thinking about the concept of the tabernacle and having the Lord with you. And I recall some of the Israelites saying, let's go back to Egypt. I guess for me that relates to that part of us that wants to go back away from the light into ignorance and the cloud, and that actually having the light with you means that you're in a desert, and that you have to walk around a desert for 40 years. That's kind of the... It's weird, like we have the Lord with us, and I was thinking about what David said about, you know, having the Lord with us means that we actually realise that we're in the desert and that we have to journey through the desert for 40 years before we can find our home. So it's a real...
bummer.
In that regard as well, at the end of Exodus 33, in a way it's a warning that even though we progress onwards, we're never going to see the Lord face to face, we're always going to see him from behind. That's one thing. The other thing I came up while we were talking is, what did the Israelites do when God met with Moses in his tent? I told you.
They looked. They came out and looked.
Yeah. Now, there's a lovely sermon in the latest New Church Life. It's by Walter Borthwine on the lilies of the field. I'm not sure exact text, but he just makes a passing reference to that which caught my eye because I was looking at this chapter at the time. What must you do even if you're going to see the Lord afar? You don't see him very clearly. And though you'll be in a natural state.
Come out of your tent.
Come out of your tent. Now, what's your tent? It's your preconceptions.
Yeah. Yeah.
Your mindsets and your preconceptions. Yeah. Even if you're going to sort of have make some sense of what the Lord is saying. Like, you know, when you... I spoke to... Philip just yesterday, I talked about mercy. We talked about mercy. Well, you know, maybe I'll say that next time I ever have to say it. Come out of your tent, because, you know, if you're going to see anything of the Lord in that teaching and the Beatitude, blessed are the merciful, for they shall, you've got to come out of your tent. You can't stick in there in the dark. You've got to be prepared to say, well, that's a possibility. You know, unless people see there's a possibility, well, forget it. They'll stay in the tent and stay asleep.
That's the same as the Sea of Galilee when Jesus said, get out of the boat. He said, I'm not going to spill the water with you in the boat. You better get out.
Yeah.
With the possibility of going down.
Yeah, absolutely.
But you'll never know unless you get out of the boat.
Ben, yes, anything other than before we go on? Bear with us now as we read some of these paragraphs. I'm glad we've got a little bit of time to do this. Simply because reading it in a group and in the sphere which is generated by a group can be very helpful. You don't feel as if you're sort of swimming against the tide or swimming in deep water when you can feel like that when you're by yourself. So the paragraphs I chose, I didn't intend, obviously didn't intend to bring 25 copies and 12 volumes of Arcanus Vesta. But David, very kindly, sent me an email to David, can you run us some paragraphs for me because you've got research. So have I, Michael, but I don't know how to use it.
You should have told me, I would have brought it on my laptop. I have it on mine.
Yeah.
I can get on my new computer.
You have to get a patch. Send me an email to remind me.
Need to download an extra patch.
Yeah. My PC crashed and I was a bit of surface getting everything.
Would you start, Patrick, would you start with the first couple of paragraphs and we'll just...
And Jehovah spoke to Moses with instruction regarding the essential nature of the worship and the church amongst the Israelite nation. This is clear from the meaning of speaking when done by Jehovah as an instruction dealt with in the places referred to in the reason why instruction regarding the essential nature of the worship and the church amongst the Israelite nation is meant is that the worship is dealt with in the present chapter, as may be recognised from the contents of the chapter declared above in 10:52-3.
Yeah. Well, that's actually why I put that there, Patrick, is because that actually sets the scene, and it's rather relentlessly. The arcana treatment of this chapter is in fact relentlessly on this level, you know, telling us about this people who were so external and all of these things we stiff-necked and so on. And that set the scene for it, actually. It comes pretty well close to the beginning of it. It's just on and on and on and on. That's why I've made such an effort at the beginning, to try to switch you away from that kind of focus and look at, hey, hang on a minute, this is about us. It is all about us. You want to go on, Patrick?
Yeah. Go up from here, you and the people whom you have caused to come up out of the land of Egypt to the land. Means that this nation will represent the church, but the church will not reside among them because they cannot be raised from external things.
Stop a moment. Now, what is that saying to you? What is that sentence saying to you? The church will not reside among them because they cannot be raised from external things. The church cannot arise out of the natural level within us. You know how the writers say, we don't regenerate the old will, the Lord has to constitute a new will. So it's no use thinking, because the old will is all about us. That's the all about me thing. What am I going to get out of this? And the Lord can't work with that. He has to work with something different. He's got to construct something different. Sorry for stopping you, but I'm just trying to alert you to what points are being made here, if you think of it in terms of yourself.
Well, I think it's really helpful because the number of people that get trapped in the idea that it's about being good as opposed to doing good. You know, it's offering, like I often direct people back to the story of Cain and Abel. It's Cain's offering, trying to offer up something that just cannot
make
into heaven, because it's hell. You know, so it's the whole idea of merit is so intertwined. In this, and in us, you know, we are constantly trying to offer up bargain with God, you know, like this, and we'll both be happy.
This is clear from the meaning of going up to the land, as in order to establish the church, for the land in the word means the church, see in the places referred to in 9:3-5. And going up to it means establishing it, since it was for that purpose that they were being led or going up towards it. Though not establishing the church, only representing it is meant here, because the interest of that nation lay in external things and not what was internal. And the church resides with a person in what is internal within. The fact that not establishing the church, only representing the things that constitute the church, is meant here explains why it says go up from here, and also you and the people whom you have caused to come up out of the land of Egypt. Thus with Moses, not Jehovah, thus with Moses, not Jehovah, caused to come up. And in a subsequent verse, I will not go up in your midst, since you are a stiff-necked people, meaning that what is divine is not among them. And where what is divine is not received inwardly, no church exists either, only an outward representation of a church. And from the meaning of causing to come up out of the land of Egypt as being raised from external things to what is internal, but here not being so raised, since it says that Moses caused them to come up and not that Jehovah did so. For this meaning of causing to come up out of the land of Egypt, see 10.21. Yes,
you did very well.
No church resided among the Israelite nation, only that which was representative of the church, see those numbers, and wherever it is spoken of in the previous chapter.
There we are.
Okay.
And then
there's anybody who
wants to say anything about
that? I was just going to say here that this really is, that we don't have a church within us. If we're on our own, particularly in the beginning, when we start to do the right thing and look towards, well, I want to go to heaven. And so it's that kind of state that, well, I'll change myself.
I want to benefit.
Because that's this state here where everybody starts.
Yeah, I want to benefit.
So is Moses the Lord in the natural mind?
What do you say?
Well, yes, because the Lord, Moses is establishing the church on a purely natural level of the mind.
Any other comments?
I think that last paragraph there about no church is like among the Israelite nations, well, it also reflects on what we're talking about this morning when we're saying is the Lord in the tree out there, all things space, where this church, because it's external, the Lord is not in that. That can only be on an internal level the same way we're talking about where is the Lord in time and space this morning.
Yeah, that's a
good
point. So the church is, like the thing that I wrote was, the church is not in representatives.
Glenn?
I have a friend who's son of a Christian minister, and he talks about how destructive it was of his honesty. As a child, he would leave the house and his mother would always say, remember who you are, as the son of a minister. In other words, you go out there and look good. And he became an incredible pathological liar. And it wasn't until he ended up confronting a federal judge on an embezzlement charge that his will was broken and he began to be able to look at the... Still battles with being an incredible pathological liar. And I just think about when we opened up this first beginning of the reading, you and the people, Jimmy Buffett has a song, "We are the people our parents warned us about." And to me, that's a much healthier message to take to this. Than to think, remember who you are as you go out into that external worship. I'm the people so my parents warned me about. Don't forget that.
It's quite good, though, what Patrick just said about who Moses is at this stage. Because it's not God. It's not being raised an internal church. It is, Patrick, your sense of God in this external state. And it's interesting that he, you know, we all know that you can look at these meanings from many angles and at different levels, but going through my mind also is that Moses really, his task, he never got into the promised land though he saw it, but his job was just to keep an order going, you know, to keep it together until they got there. Joshua took it over and began the fights, you know, began the battles.
Well, yeah, and because it says here that it's not God,
yes, exactly,
who establishes this church religion is Moses.
It's one step removed from Pharaoh, isn't it? Moses just taken over from Pharaoh as the leader.
It is, that's right. But then you see, the Lord is gentle with us.
Yes, it's a small step progression. Yeah.
My mind keeps going back to what David said earlier about the, I think you talked about the subtleties. And I'm thinking about the social convention that keeps me in this.
Yes.
There's so much involved. I mean, I just think about how I sometimes think, well, I should be better than this now, because I've been working on this for so long. Mm-hmm. So I should be better than this. And then it can even go to, people will expect me to be better than this now. So that keeps me, that social convention in looking good, keeps me in this if I am not careful and looking on the inside.
Would you say that behind that social convention, though perhaps not identified as such, is your sense of God?
It's all mixed in.
Yes, and it is for me mixed in, even the social conventions. I have kind of a vague and identified sense, well, it's still pleasing to God.
Well, the other thing is I know how much of me is in this, and yet I am trying to follow God at the same time.
Yes.
Yeah, it is. Yeah. I'm a bit like that, Mary. I feel I get full at times because I feel as if I'm trying to do this, but I know underneath there's a lot that doesn't match up. Mm-hmm. And so.
You too, huh?
Someone's targeting us. That's pretty funny. Targeting us. You know? Because I'm coming back to more than anyone.
Yeah. Yeah.
Coming back to more, in a nutshell, what does it represent?
And here, remember here, I just ran it past Patrick as I think, capturing what he said, it's our sense of God in these external states when we are following Mary's words, social conventions or people's expectations, or living a little bit out of fear of reputation, of all those
what
sorts
people
of
will think.
What people think, all of that. So Moses is our sense, and he doesn't raise us to a true church. Only God can do that, you see. So this external sense of God, i.e. Moses, will not do it. In fact, another way of putting it is another definition is Moses is our external conscience.
Yeah.
And he's not going to get us into the promised land. He'll take us to the promised land, but he'll not get us there.
Mm-hmm.
So he's our external conscience. Now, your external conscience is built up with what who you are. Our family doesn't do those sorts of things. All that sort of stuff.
So he's similar to John the Baptist?
Yeah. Is it Glenn?
Is he John the Baptist?
Yes.
I think so, yeah.
On some level, yeah.
Yeah.
Well, he's the word on David, right? So what Moses is here, so this is just my statement, it's still Jehovah that speaks to Moses, and Moses conveys to the others. But Moses, Moses provides the instructions. So, you know, you get all these instructions, you can build your beautiful tabernacle and, you know, have all your books of regulations and whatever it happens to us, you can all have it there, and there's this edifice to what Moses has received, but if nothing's done with it, it's just a representation. So Moses represents the representation of
what is good. So the representation can still teach you what is good.
Yeah. Oh, yeah.
But if you get stuck in the representation, that's not it.
Yeah.
What people were saying about, you know, they feel like they're trying to do it on one level and then they find it's, you know, you find it's just all back to the start. But I think every time we're working on a new falsity, we're back at the start with that falsity. We've only just discovered it, so we're back with Moses with that falsity, and we might be making some progress with another one. But so that's why we keep going back.
It's very scientific.
Yeah, it's very scientific.
Yeah. You have finished page one for us, Patrick.
Which I swore to Abraham, Isaac, and Jacob, to your seed I will give it, means the church promised to those who have within themselves from the Lord the good of love and the truths of faith. This is clear from the meaning of swearing when done by Jehovah, as confirmation from the divine within the internal man dealt with in those times. Thus also a promise made by the divine. For what has been promised by the divine is also confirmed by him from the representation of Abraham, Isaac, and Jacob in a higher sense as the Lord in respect of the divine self and the divine human, and in the relative sense as heaven and the church that we see ourselves. And from the meaning of their seed, as those who have within themselves the good of love and the truths of faith from the Lord, and so in the abstract sense, as the good of love and the truth of faith that we have ourselves.
Now, I'm going to push you on a little bit because the next paragraph answers your question about John the Baptist. Do you want somebody else to read it for you? Or you?
I'm kind of into it now.
Go ahead.
And I will send an angel before you means that which is divine and the Lord's, from which the church and its worship spring. This is clear from the meaning of an angel in a higher sense as the Lord's divine human, and in a relative sense, as that which is divine and the Lord's in heaven among angels, and also in the church among people on earth, dealt with below. And from the meaning of sending before you as preparing. For the meaning of an angel in the higher sense as the Lord's divine human, see those numbers, and in a relative sense as that which is divine and the Lord's in heaven among angels. And from this it follows that an angel also means that which is divine and the Lord's among people on earth who receive it. For those people who have within themselves from the Lord the good of love to him and the truths of faith in him become angels after death. And those who become angels are also inwardly such while they live in the world. This is why John the Baptist is called an angel in the word, as in Luke. This is he of whom it is written, "Behold, I send my angel before your face, who will prepare your way before you." Do you want me to keep going?
Yeah, please, Martin.
Okay. And the fact that angel in this declaration means that which was divine and Lord's with him is evident in Malachi. "Behold, I send my angel who will prepare the way before me. And suddenly there will come to his temple the Lord whom you are seeking, and the angel of the covenant in whom you delight."
Please keep going to the end of this number.
Okay. The reason why that which is divine and the Lord's is meant by angel in this instance is that John the Baptist represented the Lord in respect of the Word, as did Elijah, and the Word is divine truth that comes from the Lord. For Elijah, that he represents the Word, see preface to Genesis 18, those numbers, and that John the Baptist did so, see that number, and it is because the Lord's divine human is meant in the higher sense by angel that the words, there will come to his temple the Lord and the angel of the covenant, are used. The temple is his divine human, as is evident in John 2:18-23. Both expressions, the Lord and the angel, are used because he is called the Lord on account of divine good and the angel on account of divine truth. And it is because Jehovah in the Word is the Lord himself that it says, I send my angel who will prepare the way before me. This being said by Jehovah.
Does that help you with John Baptist now?
I hadn't read, the memory of that scripture, it said I was sent to my messenger. But actually throwing angel in there, kind of.
Yeah.
To this major comic, I guess.
So the angels that bring us messages must all be spiritual angels, not celestial angels, because they represent bringers of truth. Yeah. The celestial angels are more just there.
Spiritual angels. Yeah. They can bring us feelings.
Yeah. Mm. There should be another word for them.
We just stop and pause and think of your feelings when you see person in terrible distress, compassion, floods through.
That's
from the highest angels. Is everybody, I just like to ask, we're going to stop in a few minutes, I'd just like to ask, is everybody feeling abreast of this, not feeling dragged along, or I'm very keen, I know David most of all would be, but can you feel part of what's unfolding or what has been unfolding? Is that the case? Please let us know if you feel you're drowning or struggling or anything like that, because that's not where we want anybody to be, not at all. It is a challenge to get into these readings, but like I said, it's such a good opportunity to do it as a group, and then you don't feel as bewildered by it and as overwhelmed by it as you can do by yourself. That's one of the great beauties of
hearing other people's comments.
Hearing other people's comments, their insights as well, Laurie. And I just want to say this as well, that thinking about the seminar and the weeks coming up to it, you can be absolutely sure that I was looking forward, and obviously am looking forward to learning as much as giving, because there's so many things that each of you has to offer. If you don't feel shy or feel that your point of view is inadequate or your insight is in some way doesn't measure up, because we've all in this process of helping one another. I just want to share this with you. I do not believe regeneration is a solo effort. I don't believe the Lord would have washed the feet of the disciples unless he had a message for us. And for me, that message is that we need each other in the process of regeneration. We will not accomplish it solo. And the seminars are this marvellous opportunity to interact, listen, be stimulated, sometimes be challenged. I liked David's comment as well this morning, where he talked about the deconstruction. I thought, what a good word to use, that there are ways we look at which need deconstructing so that we can, with the Lord, reconstruct the way we're looking at things and seeing things. I thought that was just a wonderful word which I'll never forget. Deconstruct so that we can reconstruct. But what a wonderful thing it is that we can do it together. So please, everybody, feel included. Then
just to add to that, I know that I have often said churches are often barriers to spiritual growth because they put us in this mindset of looking good, and heaven help me if people would know what I was really like on the inside, they would throw me out, you know, those thoughts we have. And so we're all busy looking good, but I'm so excited about the kind of work that is actually everywhere in the new church world, of people doing spiritual growth work, global praxis, looking more deeply at ourselves and then sharing honestly on that level. And I really look forward to the day when the externals of our congregations will be changed. And I think that will happen through the small group process, but I think it can happen in the larger group process, where we're not so obsessed with, you know, how we look to one another, because we all know now that, well, our feet are made of clay, and that will be a magnet for people who are looking for something different. And I have real hope for congregational worship and congregations, but I think it really is going to need this kind of being willing to be open and honest and share, you know, the ugly stuff and our struggles with that.
I'm going to just about finish, but I'd like you to sort of
can I just ask a quick question? My own feelings of, am I making any progress? I'd be interested to know other people's feelings of how do they know they've made any progress from some of these natural states.
Good. We'll throw it open in a sec. But okay, I'll throw it open first. But I don't want to put any prism on. Please.
Well, if I can respond to that. Sometimes, you know, I feel that I've come a long way at times because of looking back at where I was and how I would have reacted at certain things years ago. But then, you know, within hours or minutes, I do something or I think something and I go, well, hang on, how much have I actually really progressed? And so in reality, it's being caught up in that whole concept of time, and that's as states fluctuate like this. And for us, we look at it over time, it's like 10, 15 years is a long time. And you think, well, look, I should be here right now. But even that, I'm thinking to myself, I've got to sort of get out of that and just look at, well, if I'm facing the right direction, I'm okay.
Well, I keep thinking I'm an Israelite and I'm not ever moving.
Going on with the desert, I think it's a number of times that you realise you're in the desert. Now, the number of times when I want to do something that's easier for me, but the number of times a little voice says, yeah, but is that the right thing to do for them? And it's, no, it's not. All right. and then I do it. But it's not spiritual because I'm not doing it. I love it. Okay, you told me I'm doing it, right? And that, what I've noticed is that's occurring a lot more. Things, and it's the awareness that you set up. You're getting more sensitive. You know, things which you want to say, oh, I'm sitting down, I don't care. Now it says, oh, well, that's up to you, but it's not the best for them. It's all right. That happens a lot more. But doesn't matter. I don't see I've made a lot of progress in wanting to do it, but I'm obeying this thing, often reluctantly, but the voice is coming more often.
Can I just say a couple of things went through my mind? One is, don't allow yourself to be talked down, Liz. There was a wonderful little clip that David Miller put me onto a few weeks ago. From Brenatham, a youngish child was giving a talk about head bullies or something like that. Boy, just brilliant. He was talking about influx, we never used the word, but how these, you know, we get bullied around with these ideas, we're no good, we're a waste of time, we never achieve anything. Look, you know, regeneration is like this, and as you see, the Lord doesn't ever promise to wipe away unregenerate states. What he does is he says, I'll push it more to the circumference, which means that occasionally, unfortunately, you can leap out at you from the bush and ambush you because it's still there. But when it does, usually your contrition is more heartfelt and deeper than it was 5 years ago. You look appalled at yourself for what you did. So that's that sensitivity which you have. So the bullying stuff, you've got to be very careful with these voices. The other thing is, I think we have to trust that so long as we're, who said it, pointing in the direction and working with it to the best of our ability, I think we should let it go at that point. The reason is that if we try to go any further, we and identify change, then the likelihood is we start claiming merit for it.
Mm.
Now the Lord clearly says that the main thing is to shun those evils of which we're a conscience, leave the rest to Him. Now, and maybe, Liz, maybe, like Helmut has said, there are times when you're just thankful that you didn't react or blow up or whatever like you've done 10 years ago. And maybe also people will reflect back to you something which gives you encouragement. That will be the Lord's providence, that perhaps you need encouragement at that time. I remember after leaving Britain in 1968-69, and 25 years, many years later, I saw a chap who I never felt able to get near, an older man. Oh, he seemed so obsessed and gruff. And he came out to Australia, and I couldn't have noticed the change. Well, I couldn't help, I just thought, he's not the same person. And somebody very gently but rightly said to me, Ian, doesn't our church allow for change? I've never forgotten that. But I saw it, he probably wasn't aware of it, but I saw it. So maybe, as I said, the Lord in His providence will occasionally, either like Helmut says, remind you that you're not reacting like you did, or somebody themselves will reflect that back to you.
In the quiet moments of the morning, and I'm about to hit a very busy day, I ask for guidance, and then I let go and let God, and I see God in the faces of the children that I teach, and in their artworks, because I get them to do authentic works. I never give an outline or something or a stencil. They do authentic spiritual works every day. One exercise that came to me, because God's giving me these ideas all the time. And some days I have no idea what I've got, and I've got a child's hand in mine, the rest of the class behind, and I'm walking 200 metres to my room because I have to collect 5 kindy classes and put them back. I'm thinking, please God, give me a lesson. And then I get into the room and it's there, it's waiting for me. And I hand out the paper and I say, okay, I'm going to get you to do an inside portrait. And I drew around their heads on an A3 and they drew what was in their mind. Their mum was in their mind, on the top of their mind. Their father's cubby house with the tree was in their heart, because that's where they love to spend their time. And their father did that for them, and the friends they play with, their dog, their cat. Then behind them was where they came from. A little Chinese boy said, I said, what, where are you from? Is it China? What's in China? People, lots of people. And he was 5 years old, and he drew lots of people and a long fence, you know, the wall. So that's about his past and his heritage. And then I have a safe day because I'm a fast driver. I've got lots to do. I'm thinking I've got home safe. The children are happy. We've got food. I'm still in work. Everything that came to me, I see that as God thanking me, or God in me, and giving me rewards back. Yeah. A safe and guidance. That's how I know I'm regenerating, by his gifts back to me. Yeah.
Beautiful said.
Yeah.
I want to just get you to look one last few lines, and I'll stay with it. It's 10546. No, let's stop it. 10546. Just because it's picked up on the notion that he's coming. 10546.
And pitched it for himself outside the camp, far away from the camp. Means remote from the external things in which the interest of the actual nation lay. This is clear from the meaning of pitching a tent as providing, arranging, and setting in order the things that belong to the church and worship. For the tent means the holiness of the church, worship, and the word dealt with immediately above in 10:4-5. So that pitching it means providing, arranging, and setting those things in order. And from the meaning of the camp, as the heavenly order which heaven and the church arise from and conform to. And since all the truths and forms of good of heaven and the church are elements of that order, that which contains them is also meant. The reason why these elements are meant by the camp is that by the children of Israel, who made up the camp, all truths and forms of good in their entirety are meant. But when the children of Israel worship the calf instead of Jehovah, their camp had a contrary, namely hellish order, and also that which contains falsity and evil that compose hell. When you speak of the external things of worship and the church without anything internal, or you speak of hell, it amounts to the same thing. For people whose worship is external and not at all internal are ruled by self-love and love of the world. And self-love and love of the world come from hell. This is evident why Moses took his tent and pitched it outside the camp, far from the camp. For the tent, as has been stated above, meant the holiness of worship, the church and the word. And why those words mean remote from the external things in which the interests of the Israelite nation lay.
Right.